podcast, Death Protection Made Easy podcast. I'm standing in for Oliver. We've burnt him out over the last few episodes, and he's needing a couple of days rest, so he'll hopefully be back with us all guns firing next week. So I'm joined today by Phil Brining and Eddie, so hi to you two.
Hello. Hi there.
And for the normal running of things, we have a display with the privacy information on screen. Just a quick look, we will be recording the podcast, and you can pick it up from any great stockists to listen back to, including Spotify. So please do go and have a listen back if you need to, and recommend it to your friends and your family and anybody else who's interested. It's really a great read. So that's on there. So today, let's move on. I'm starting to sound a bit like Boris. I'm just bluffing and bolstering my way through. So let's move on. So the topic of today is training, and we'll get on to discussing the ins and outs of training in that sense. So just moving on before we start looking at that, we normally at this section just have a quick snippet of what was in the news. And anybody that was listening before I started with the official introduction, we were talking about the consultation guidance document that was produced by the by our European friends in relation to restricted transfers
and how that's sweaty or not. In the winter, that bridge is too exposed.
Steph, put yourself on mute.
How many diet?
I'll see if I can mute you, Steph. It's very interesting about frozen bridge. I think that's what I caught. But we were talking about the restricted transfers and guidance out by European partners and European friends on restricted transfers and what that means. It's consultation documents. And we were literally just talking about the guidance or the document that kind of indicates if you've got an employee that decides that they want to go on holiday but access the systems, dial in and have a look at things, whether that's classed as a transfer or not to a foreign country in any of those senses. And the consultation document comes out from Europe saying it's not to be considered as a restricted transfer. Did you see that, Phil?
I did. As I say, I downloaded it to read and it sat on my desktop to read. But I was very interested, as you were, in that opinion.
No, I thought it was interesting because the ISO guidance is quite similar to that they're not classed as restricted transfers. But I think it's one that would be useful just to kind of kick around. Maybe need to have a look at it in a bit more depth, because there's still data going backwards and forwards, arguably, from my very limited understanding. If anybody's got any IT knowledge that would like to chip in and unmute, please feel free to do so. It is your session, and it's in that sense. My understanding, that there is still bits going backwards and forward in packets and stuff.
It's one of those things to me, Dave, and you know, by all means, everyone dive in and shoot me down. But it's one of those things that's a bit ambiguous, isn't it? So, you know, there's clearly packets of data going across borders, but you know, the interpretation is that it's not a restricted transfer. And I was talking to Matthew earlier in the week. He was talking about the CCTV system and you know, the ICO's guidance, as we've talked about with photographs, that you know, if the CCTV system captures somebody in a wheelchair, then that's not classified as information about their disability unless you use it for the purpose of identifying people in wheelchairs. So it brings in this notion of, you know, what's the purpose of the processing, and then if it's not, if even if it's patently obvious that you know, from the information captured by the CCTV system, that the individual, you know, it's medical or it's religious or it's, you know, trade union membership or whatever, that's not special category data unless you're using the system to collect the information for that specific purpose, to identify those traits. But then, as we know, you know, you might find that your purpose changes down the road. You know, at some point you are looking for, you know, somebody's vandalised a car, and then you're saying, you know, that rather than an individual vandalised a car at 9 o'clock, you're saying, you know, a white male in a wheelchair vandalised a car at 9 o'clock. But as soon as you start introducing those nuances, and the purpose changes, and all of a sudden it becomes special category data, and all of a sudden you're looking for lawful grounds. And it seems a bit like that, you know. You transfer data, an employee dives into your systems and pulls data out and downloads it, let's say, to their system across boundaries, across borders. It is an international transfer, but not regulated by the GDPR, and unless in those circumstances, but I'm sure there will be other circumstances.
Yeah,
there
does.
Fast as a restricted transfer. I'm doing a Peppa Pig. Carry on.
There's a couple of bits on there, just trying to cover off. One would be if you're looking at a restricted transfer, I guess, is between a controller and a controller, or a controller and a processor. So would it still be technically in the way the law is written, a transfer, when it's actually between your employer and the employee that seem to be an agent of the company, not necessarily either a controller or a processor in that sense? Saying it's not necessarily regulated, I agree with, but you still have to consider security implications depending on the country that they're in, accessing it, what risks that might pose to yourself as an organisation from those points. So I'd certainly be saying that you should be kind of still thinking about the potential for risk and what that may mean and the impact for that what that may have on the organisation.
Why do you raise security? What's the relevance of that?
Well, you've just got to have appropriate technical and organisational measures in place. So would security be weakened or would you be infringing any security measures by accessing the information? Say, for example, your employee said that they wanted to go and have a two-week tour of China, for example, and they're dialing in from China or anywhere else, I'm just picking on the Chinese, but dialing in from somewhere else, would that necessarily have an impact on your security that's in place? You may find because of if you've got a laptop that's the IP address is recognised by your network, it may be fine. You may also find that your network says anything out of this particular region is not fine, so the individual may be inhibited anyway. So it's just trying to understand what security is in place and whether it's appropriate and what the risks are by enabling somebody to do that.
Well, Peter raises a good point. You know, if you're logging in from a VPN, in theory, you could be anywhere. You're going through the secure method. But Article 44 doesn't mention anything about security, does it? It just says any transfer of personal data which are undergoing processing or intended for processing or transfer to to a third country or an international organisation, so it'll take place only if subject to other provisions of the regulation, blah, 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 blah. So it's not, at that point, not interested in security. It's saying if it's going out of the UK, then you've got to comply with these other aspects of the UK GDPR. You know, one of those, things you might say is, well, we've got security around the transfer, but well, so what? This is a transfer to a third country, or not, as the case may be.
So, do you think it offers any additional guidance?
It's a transfer to a third country, but because the person transferring it is employed by your organisation, i.e., controller, it's not classified as restricted transfer. That's the nuance of it, isn't it?
It is. Yeah, it is.
Anyway,
moving on from that point, anything else?
That was an interesting, right, really.
Has anything else caught anybody's eyes and ears in the news today or this week? I've, like yourself, Phil, have been bogged down with audit work for 27001. And trying to make sure measures are in place for the full audit that's coming up. So my eyes not necessarily been on the ball this week with the news.
Well, I was interested in Atom Bank introducing a four-day working week, 34 hours, and I was thinking, wonder if we could make that work at data protection people.
34 hours or a four-day week?
Four-day week.
Anyway, that's I won't be in Monday, and let me know.
Discussion for SMT. Anyway, moving on, data protection.
So, moving on, I suppose I'm sure everybody's have heard, well, may have if you've been on these sessions quite regularly, have met Eddie previously. But Eddie's our training manager. He's here today to talk about training. So we'll hand over. I've actually just realised I really ought to put my camera on today because I am in the office. I'm based in Leeds. So there I am in the office in Leeds, and I'm introducing Eddie to talk about training and bits and pieces around training, what's good, what's bad, what we've seen, how to improve it and so on. So welcome, Eddie.
Hi there. Thanks very much, David. My first time on one of these podcasts, so I hope you don't get too tongue-tied.
Apology, I thought you'd been on one before. It must be the recording that went out on LinkedIn that I'm referring to.
All right. Okay. Yeah. Training. And what I did was go back and have a look at where training is reflected in the GDPR, and it's only shown in one place in Article 39, where a data protection officer, where they're referring to that, and they mention training there about training of employees for data protection. So there is only one area within the regulations which reflects on it in that way. So, but that would be implicit in that, you know, all employees should have a level of training to understand what the requirements are there and their obligations within an organisation. Unless you know of anywhere else, David?
Well, I think it's you mentioned there Article 39, so it's putting it within the kind of the task of the duties of the DPO in that kind of stuff. So it's explicitly mentioned there, but I think it's also implicitly mentioned within the GDPR as well, in the sense that if you, again, it's probably going to be my little topic this week, looking at technical and organisational measures and security measures, but if you're implementing things, whether it's a new process, whether it's a new procedure, whether it's a new bit of kit, in that sense, surely it's implicit that training will be provided to individuals in order to help reduce risk, so they're knowledgeable about the processes that they're following and the ways that they need to operate in line with your own internal policy procedures, rules and regulations around personal data and things. So I would have said it was implicit, and likewise I've also come across where incidents are investigated by the regulator, that the regulator will ask for training records in that sense. So I think it's, if not explicit, I still think it's implicit. Have you got anything to add to that, Phil?
Well, only that that there is a specific requirement in the PCIDSS requirement 12.6 for security awareness training. There's also a specific requirement in ISO 27001 and 8.2 for security awareness training. And I believe there is also a specific requirement in Cyber Essentials Plus for security awareness training. So, you know, what I think we need to be doing is building, a kind of a culture where, you know, training is there. But we always come back to the world of training in what? So, you know, it doesn't to me, it doesn't have to be explicitly set out in the GDPR, because, you know, how could you possibly have a procedure to appoint processes or for undertake a DPIA, for instance, or for, you know, drafting a privacy notice and not train people in it? I mean, it has to be implicit throughout that you have to train people in how to operate these technical and organizational measures. You know, and it is there. The DPO, if there is one, is responsible for this and the next thing. But if there isn't a DPO, does the obligation to undertake the training and make the control aware of their responsibilities, does it disappear? Well, no, it can't, can it?
Well, I was following through this theme with the ICO, and if you look in their accountability framework, they've got a heading there for training and awareness, and it touches quite explicitly on areas that need to, well, best guidance to be addressed. So all staff data protection information governance training program includes induction and refresher training for all staff on data protection and information governance. So what we're seeing from there, that training is for all from entry level up. And it also specifies that senior management must sign off all the training. So the accountability piece is in there as well. So where we're talking about training records there, you know, the accountability framework actually picks up on that. And the point that you said there, Phil, about specialist roles, that's identified there as well. If someone's got a specialist role and a particular element of training that they need to have in that area for that specialist role, that must also be identified and followed through as well through TNAs, gap analysis, training plans, that sort of thing.
Yeah. So would it be worth then digging into a little bit deeper now? So you clearly have got a need for training training people and things.
Let me just highlight, as I mentioned earlier on in the day, that when the ICO fined Heathrow Airport in 2018, in their monetary penalty notice at paragraph 27, they're critical of the fact that only 2% of Heathrow Airport's 6,500 employees had received data protection training. And that training wasn't in place for the security trainers. So again, the ICO took that as mitigating, you know, aggravating circumstances, not mitigating, aggravating circumstances, and, you know, issued a monetary penalty notice. So again, they're calling out here, you know, not that you have to do it, but they're critical when it's not being done.
No, for sure. And that's kind of the point we were looking at in relation to the ICO request training records and things to kind of take that consideration forward. But when we're looking at training and things, you mentioned there, Eddie, that training's got to be delivered to everybody at induction and across the board. So digging a little bit deeper in there, if you kind of look at that, would that then indicate that you've got to have different levels of training? Would you, and it's just asking questions, different levels, would you expect board training, board members to go through basic training and then board training, so their specific responsibilities, or would they just have specific trainings aboard, for example?
I would expect everyone to go in any organisation, irrespective of it being around data protection, out of that, for everyone to have an understanding at the very basic induction level and have a good basis, a good, groundwork on what the basics are. And I would say that should really apply to everyone, and it should be refreshed on a regular basis. And when we say refreshing, it's not just doing the same stuff again. Obviously, you need to see if anything's changed within the organisation, or there's been, that will be included in any refresher training. So it would reflect anything that's new or any other themes that need to be explored. Yeah, definitely.
Steph's point is spot on, into that, you know, the lack of training can completely undermine the effectiveness of the technologies that you've implemented. And this is your hobby horse, isn't it, Dave, as well? So you put in place all these systems. We've been recruiting at the moment, so I've been trying to grapple with Indeed. There's no training on how to use Indeed. And I can send out bad messages from Indeed. And I sent the wrong message to the wrong candidate yesterday because I got no training in how to operate Indeed. And it's the same with, you know, that's just a system I choose to use. But, you know, we don't do enough training on our own internal Salesforce system. We don't do enough training on how to use our SharePoint system and our Office 365. And I don't think we're probably unique in that. I think many organizations potentially don't do enough training on the apps that they expect their employees to pick up and use. There seems to be this assumption that they're intuitive. Well, I'll tell you what.
Salesforce isn't, though.
I would tend to agree with that, because I've often been involved with root cause analysis, looking at incidents when they really go wrong with some of our clients and bits and pieces. And although you can kind of go, well, it's human error and it's technology use, it's not invariably, a lot of the technology is pretty good. It's just our use of the technology. So there's kind of saying it's a human error element. As you know, when you do root cause analysis and things, you don't generally kind of just, well, it's human error and that's it. We'll just leave it there. You do try to look at several different areas and several different topics. And kind of, I've come to, and it's only my opinion, and I apologize if it upsets anybody. It's not there to upset people, but I often find there's a mismatch of a disconnect between competence and confidence. So therefore, people are very similar to what you mentioned there with Indeed, Phil, where you think you're doing the right thing, you think you're following the right process, your confidence probably outstrips your knowledge of how to do it properly and how to do it safely. Mm. And therefore, as a consequence of that and seeing that, I think it's vitally important that we do identify processes, identify systems, as organisations, that we identify these things and that we train people appropriately on it. We can talk around training around data protection and what that looks like, or how training's delivered and in what formats. But I think it must include how to use systems and how to follow processes correctly. And that's got to be it's got to be logged, and it's got to be some kind of cycle to that, because systems update, processes. You imagine if you said to me, Dave, look, I'm going to train you on SharePoint, and we had the old SharePoint version that wasn't in the cloud, and now we've got the new SharePoint with all the bells and whistles hanging on it. Surely the training should reflect that change.
Yeah, some good comments here about the data security, data protection, the data security and protection toolkit requiring learning and the PSN as well. So, good. You know, what's good for the public sector? You know, why isn't it similarly applied to private sector or other sectors? You know, unless you're going through these other accreditations. But the PCI stuff, security awareness training, is different to that. Is different to data protection compliance training, isn't it? And this isn't about, you know, this is the law. I mean, that we see too much training as this is the law. There are seven principles, and these are they. They have to be applied. People have to be able to apply them to their own role and what they're doing in their own jobs in that particular organisation. So, it shouldn't be. And too much data protection training used to be anyway. Just a regurgitation of the legal requirements rather than the opportunity to understand them, how they apply to you in your role in this org.
No, absolutely. And it comes back to, I can bring Eddie in at this point. It comes back to a quote that I quite like that I sent over to Eddie a while ago to involve with some of our training. And it's a quote, I believe, to be fair, it's not a quote attributed to me. I nicked it off the internet, but somebody has associated it with Einstein. And the quote is that education is not the learning of facts, but the training of the mind to think. So surely data protection training, information security training should be training the mind to think about those matters. The fact that you can remember all the seven principles, you can remember the article where DPIA sits and stuff, yeah, well, fair enough, but it doesn't teach you to think about it, does it? It just teaches you where, which part of the law it's in that sense.
Yeah. Love that problem in chair, not in computer. That's fabulous, isn't it?
Yeah, so yeah, I'm glad you brought that up, David. I mean, that idea about teaching you to think. I saw some research not so long back, which had been produced by, let's have a look, Princeton University in America, and they've done some research into how we retain information and how we best learn. And they're saying the actual idea of just learning something rote off a page or, you know, through a presentation. Has very limited impact. You might remember it for 10 or 15 minutes or a couple of days or a couple of weeks. They say you really, really need to engage in solving problems with that particular knowledge that you just attained. So there needs to be something that's a little bit difficult to do. So once you get into that position where you're working maybe together with people in a group, or you're actually taking the knowledge that you've got and you know, you're manipulating that information, looking at different ways that it can be applied, etc., then the brain actually starts to embed that. As you said, you're starting to learn about the methodology of how you would use it, as opposed to just learning it rote. So it's quite an interesting thing there. And said the desirable way to learn is to make it slightly, and I know it sounds counterintuitive, is to make the learning process a little bit more difficult than you anticipate it should be. That is going to help you retain that information and use that information in different situations in a better way moving forward.
Interesting. I mean, what's interesting as well is that because we're running our DPO training course in January, obviously reviewing all the materials, and the key to any of this is it comes back to what exercises are we going to do to illustrate the point and cement the learning. You know, that's the key to it all, isn't it? So we're going to cover off, you know, these are legal requirements, this is what it means in practice. Right, now let's do some exercises to make sure we understand, you know, the limitations of this, or the parameters, or, you know, the prerequisites, or, you know, how to do it properly or how to shortcut things. But you know, Phil, we're doing Phil, that right now, aren't we?
Yeah, Phil, that's the part that will embed and make people understand how they can use it, you know, in real life, as opposed to kind of, all right, you know, I've seen the presentation. You're actually, it will engage them and embed that, how to use that moving forward. Definitely. Yeah, definitely.
So do you find one of the problems generally then with training is the fact that it is just taught, and you, whether it's e-learning, whether it's face-to-face, you sat there listening, you don't need to engage fully with the material or the presenter or the package that you're trying to learn from. You can kind of click through too quickly, and there's no element of making you sit down and work through scenarios, for example.
Yeah, I mean, good e-learning will do have some form of self-assessment in there, but that usually constitutes a form of quiz. And again, that's a bit limited. I think it's more about the deeper knowledge. You know, how would you work through a situation, being given a scenario, you know, using the information that you've been given, how would you approach this? It makes you engage and think about how you would use that in real life. Well, or obviously it's not real life, but it's on like that, but it gives you a scenario where you would actually take that knowledge and think, right, how would I use this in a situation? And I think, you know, from this research, and you know, I would bear that out from my experience over the years, that's when people start to get that deeper understanding of what it means to use moving forward.
So how do you make that all interesting and engaging then? Because you often hear, I often hear from your family as well, oh, data protection is a bit dry, isn't it? It's a dry subject, and then people are generally not enthused by it. So you've understood how to deliver to, and you've got some of the elements that you've already discussed. So how do you bring it all to life? How do you make people get passionate about it and understand it? And how do you...
And I think this is where we've discussed this before, David, is actually relating it to what it is. It's about people at the end of the day. You know, it's not just about fact. It's about how it affects people and the reasonings and what the impact can be and how it affects people. To make it a little bit more impactful in the way that we learn, I think we need to use several methods. I mean, the term blended learning's out there, and we're now approaching our learning to have some form of blended learning approach. And I think of any type of learning is that, you know, you've got poles apart there. You've got e-learning on one side, you've got kind of face-to-face learning on the other, and both are very good, but you need to bring in and integrate the two together in some way, shape or form for it to have the greatest impact. And I feel that helps people understand the topic better, be able to work with it in a in an environment moving forward. So multimedia could be, so e-learning, you know, which may people may just associate with a presentation. You know, what happens if we mix that up with conversation, group work, multimedia, and also it may be an element of that where, you know, that you can work either online or you can work in a face-to-face environment in a workshop approach. And I think bringing all those elements together will have the greatest impact on the person to understand and use that knowledge moving forward.
There's some interesting comments on the chat. Some really good ones, actually. I mean, Stephen is saying, what's your thoughts on workbooks, e-learning? Again, I'm interested to hear everyone's thoughts on those. But, I mean, we love them, to be honest. And we think that, you know, you can put together, and this is what we do, we've put together a generic presentation, an introduction to protection in the workplace, which comes with a workbook, because what we want people to do is then take the workbook and go off and find the answers to the questions in the workbook, or, you know, at the end of the process, the workbook becomes a record of, you know, really useful information, like, you know, the principles and some of the key bits of that we want people to know. But again, putting people in a position where they work through an exercise and record it, I really like. Now, I spoke to a guy I used to work with who's really into his digital media stuff, and he said, I can't remember the last time I wrote anything longhand. So, you know, he said, I don't like workbooks at all, because I have to think about them and I have to write in them. But if I personally love them, I think it's a great way to, and they're flexible. You know, you might have a video presentation that is expensive and can't be modified, but your workbooks, if it's a Word document, you can change them, you can tweak them for each different job role. So, Stephen, I love them. I think it's a part of an integrated blended learning approach. So I think they've really got a good role, but I don't know if anybody's got experience with that. Or
not trying to jump across anybody, and please don't mute if you've got your own personal opinions. I like the thought of takeaways from training, because too often you see training slides sometimes got a lot of words on them, which can serve a purpose if it's delivered correctly, because it can become a resource tool. But if somebody delivers training face-to-face or through e-learning, and then you say, well, the slides are available, if you're using the slides just to emphasise points within the discussion that you're talking about, the slides afterwards might not make sense to people.
They don't make sense, do they?
So then if you wanted a point of reference to go back to, then the slides, in essence, are really a bit pointless.
Because if the slides make sense, in my opinion, there's too much information on them.
For sure.
Yeah. You know, the slides should be something to structure a discussion around. But
that's right.
What do I know, eh?
Yeah, and as you said, once you take the context of the narration away from the slides and people just see the slides in isolation, it doesn't make a lot of sense unless you've got another point of reference that you can refer to give that where that narration was, or, you know, so something that they can then, oh, right, OK, there's the detail. I can then work through certain exercises with it to embed that knowledge.
Yeah, and we said, I think when we did this before, you know, we said that we were amazed how easy it is actually to get a PowerPoint deck together and then click on the record narration and, you know, record it slide by slide as a narration. You can then save that as a PowerPoint show, which is self-running. So you know that if people are watching it, they're getting exactly the message you want to get across. Because it's in PowerPoint, it's on your desktop, it's superbly flexible to create. You could also output as an MP4, so it's a video file, you know, but again, this is really easy to do, and it's using tools that we've all got available. So, you know, customized training team by team is not an expensive exercise. Something that is there for us to be able to do. It's a question of time, and in some respects, you know, confidence. I hate hearing myself on recordings, but you know, you kind of got to work through that.
It's the very reason why I don't listen to our podcast, but I know thousands of people do, but I don't listen to them because I'm on them.
I'd just like to flag up a point that Kirsty has brought up there on the chat, and it says, totally agree. If there is no workbook, I end up writing notes and not properly listening. And I think that is a very good point as well. Eddie?
Sorry.
What? Yeah, that's right. Yeah. And again, if you're anything like me, can you read those notes when you've written them down? You know, you leave them a week.
Do they make sense? Yeah, do they make sense? I mean, I went on some training course a couple of years ago, and there was like 354 slides, you know, and what you got was a PDF output of those slides. It's actually not really helpful as a learner. I'm old school, I prefer to write stuff down. You know, if I'm getting it as a PDF, it's not very good for annotating it. Mark's asking what we did, but, you know, in COVID, we were already doing a lot of training, Mark, when COVID lockdown came, and we simply moved it all into Teams or Zoom, which wasn't ideal, but it was better than nothing. So I did quite a lot of training sessions with a variety of our customers via Teams. And again, it works better in smaller groups because, you know, in the ideal, you want people with the cameras on, but you don't get the same interaction or body language. And some people aren't as comfortable putting their hands up and asking questions. And you don't get the same group chat facility and doing an exercise. You can't say, well, get yourselves in pairs. You can now, but you couldn't at the time. So I think you have different rooms you can set up in something like Zoom. But you just had to use the tools that were available. That's just mobilize and, you know, use materials, and you can distribute exercises, and you know, we did a lot of training, and it was all done in this kind of environment.
I think it's got its place. I think through Teams, Zoom, and that kind of thing's got its place. But it still comes back to me, and I know there's pros and cons to either side. But I don't like e-learning. I don't like delivering training through Teams because it's easy to disengage. So at the moment I'm on the screen here, I've got another screen behind this screen. I could be sat here listening to Phil when in fact actually I'm trying to order my Christmas shopping from Amazon in that sense, and I could make it even harder for Phil to identify whether I'm listening or not by turning my camera off and muting myself unless you kind of pick on me to answer a particular question. So I find it far too easy to disengage.
Yeah, and that comes back to Dave Parsons' point, you know, testing someone's understanding of training is the key, isn't it? So making sure that you're giving good input and an opportunity to think about and explore, and then, you know, testing to see whether there's an appropriate level of understanding, ability to apply if that's what's required. How do you do that? You know, quizzes, I suppose, you know, little tests, you know, I suppose, but most of that.
I think it needs to be a mixture of, doesn't it, really?
Discussion.
Yeah, that's it. You know, the idea of doing some form of self-assessment quiz has its place. And I think for the breadth of what you've just gone through, okay, you then can tell yourself, yeah, I understand that in the way that was intended. But I think to get that in-depth kind of feeling about that I could work with this in a real life environment, then it needs more of a taxing approach. So, you know, some form of kind of, you know, 100 words and what you would do in this sort of situation. And I don't mean as blunt as that, but I think that those two together would really be impactful. So I think the key takeaway I would say from here is we need to have a look at each of the kind of ways that we're delivering and seeing how we can put different elements to it to enable it to be as engaging as possible, i.e. people don't nod off when you're doing it. And two, to embed that learning, but use different ways to do that as well. Quizzes are good, but also to have something that would flesh out the depth of, and how you can use that in real life.
No, I agree with everything they're saying. The one thing that when you just mentioned things that kind of made my mind think a little bit, and it goes back to an issue I have with training in that sense. When you talk about complexity and trying to get people involved and trying to get people bought into it and things, is the fact that we need to make sure that we're not staying mainstream. So we're going to have individuals that might have language difficulties, that might have learning difficulties, sight difficulties, hearing difficulties that are within the workforce. So how are we making sure that the training is inclusive of everybody? How are we making sure, are we able to adapt our training delivery to ensure that everybody within the workforce has got equal representation and an equal opportunity to actually learn and understand what they should be doing?
Yeah, I mean, and I think we may have discussed this before, and I think when we're working and engaging within employers, we're probably quite guilty of that, of leaving it down to the employer to make that decision that, you know, the way that we're delivering would fit in with the person that's taken the training. But really, we should be thinking about that as well when we're putting this together.
Well, it's one thing that really kind of sat with me a few years ago now. I delivered first training. It was definitely pre-COVID, so it's at least, what now, 2 years, isn't it? And I delivered first training, and I was asked by the organisation that one individual had particular hearing difficulties, but they wanted him to go through the training course, and would I mind if there was a court reporter there in order to, so she would translate what I was saying, and he would sit next to her, and he would read the screen, look at the slides and read the screen. And it's after kind of going through that experience that kind of made me realise whether training is actually inclusive to everybody, whether it's learning difficulties, because you know, say dyslexia, whether it's language, whether it's sight, or whether it's auditory and things like that. And it really kind of drove it home to me that we're maybe not inclusive with our delivery.
Christine's point about competing, I mean, this is particularly true when you're onboarding people, isn't it? And you know, they've got to go through an absolute ton of stuff, you know, paperwork and mandatory inductory training. and this is always going to be, you know, data protection training, I think, is absolutely crucial, but it's potentially one of those that's you know, the e-learning, just sit yourself down at the computer for 20 minutes, run through that, answer the questions, get through the quiz, and then move on to something more interesting. I'm not a great fan of, I mean, it's easier to do into annual training. I much prefer the concept of, you know, bite-sized, you know, training. And it kind of makes me think, well, my rose-tinted view of life, you know, we give team leaders the materials to be able to, you know, put data protection training into their, you know, weekly meetings or something, or monthly meetings. But usually it's a specialist person, i.e. a trainer, not necessarily a data protection specialist, delivering annual training or an e-learning package. So who's doing the training, and how often is it getting done, and how big is the kind of input, or is it broken down into bite-sized bits delivered over the course of, you know, induction? You don't have to do everything in one hit, do you? You could have like five different mini courses, effectively, or mini inputs.
And in different ways as well. It wouldn't necessarily all have to be in the same way. So it doesn't necessarily all have to be a module within a program. You could have it delivered.
Yeah, most of the time you just want to get these people through the induction as fast as you can and get them sat at a desk doing some work.
Well, there is that approach, but I think it's a very short-term strategy, isn't it, really? You want the people that are in, you know, sitting behind that desk or sitting in that workplace to be able to have a proper understanding of what they should be doing and what their obligations are. So it's a very short-term approach to say, let's get them through as quickly as possible. I think, and also linking that into, people's individuals reviews with their managers, and you know, can they in any way, shape or form reflect on what training should have happened in that period of time? Is there any way that, you know, they can in that review identify where people do or don't understand the concepts that they've been taught? So I mean, that is another way of integrating into, is it being effective, do people understand, can we review it at at review level?
And I think the delivery of the training is a really interesting point. If you, coming back to whether it's induction or annual refresher training, if you only get 1 hour a year, you think you've got, what, 1,950 hours worked in a year, and you're only asking for 1 hour of that, do you think that would be sufficient? Would you say that was enough to everybody's sufficiently trained? You've got near on 2,000 hours, and I'm just taking one of those in order to make sure you're appropriately trained.
No, it's, and it goes back to that thing that you said earlier on about, you know, being able to apply that level of knowledge, are you learning, you know, the methodology, or are you just learning the words on the page that you can retain for a month, 2 months? Could you use them? Could you use that knowledge you've been given? I mean, a big thing, I think we flagged it up, but is it to make it as engaging as possible? Okay, the subject matter that we're talking about can be very dry. We just need to find an engaging way for the individuals to latch on what that is. And coming back to that point where we said it's about people, I've often seen eyebrows raised when we said, oh, right, it's about people and, you know, how it impacts on people. And you can kind of, it's almost like, oh, I never thought of it like that. And that's a sort of response, you know, in training when you deliver that you want to see from people, that it's, you know, it's made them sit up in their seats a little.
Well, it's about people and about their private lives, isn't it? And it's just trying to kind of bring that back and make people think a little bit about the fact that we potentially, how we use information within the workplace could have an impact on somebody's private life. in that kind of sense.
Yeah, I want to just explore what George is saying, because we've been through this recently, and we're thinking about refresh training as distinct from initial training or induction training. And I think that you're right, George. I think there is definitely a difference. I think putting people through the same program year on year, you know, or session by session, isn't the right approach. So, theoretically, you know, you go through the initial training, and refresh your training. Should it be covering exactly the same stuff, or should it be different? I think it should be different. It feels like it should be different. And when we were doing our own e-learning programs, we wanted to make our refresher training different. But to be fair, we struggled to make it different. We struggled to differentiate what you should know, or we're assuming you should know because you'd covered it before, or we've been doing awareness raising. I know the other point I want to pick up as well is awareness raising and the role of training and reinforcing messages. But just that one about refresher training as opposed to initial training, should it be different? Should it be the same stuff?
I think it needs to be slightly different, and I think we just need to start thinking outside the box a little bit with that. I've certainly been in organisations where the training year on year is the same stuff trotted out year on year.
Definitely.
And you just disengage with it, and it's the same questions, it's the same material, same questions, the same amount of time. And kind of coming back to the point of that they're not taking it seriously, it very much gives the impression, I'm not saying this happened, very much they kind of gave the impression of just leave that running in the background whilst you do something else, and answers the same questions that you attempted last year.
Otherwise, I was just going for the meeting.
Hang on, just No, I totally agree. And approaching any form of training that you have to do in a form of repetition should be, you know, shouldn't be the same stuff just spieled out year after year, month after month. Because,
it could be similar elements to it, but just delivered differently. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
You know what I mean? So you can still cover some of the topics, but just in a slightly different way. That obviously then means that your training material's got to have some kind of review process to it, somebody working in the background. So I guess out of these, they'll just trot out the same thing year on year, because it takes a little bit of resources to make sure things are tweaked and changed. So it just visually looks different, delivered in a different order and that kind of stuff, and maybe new material added in there as well, which all takes time and money and effort to put together. But I that's where I think, if you could kind of say, what's a perfect world for me, every year would have refresher training that is delivered differently.
No, I think that's a really great approach. I'd just like to bring up what Elise has put in here as well on the chat. He said, and I think this is a fantastic approach. We have been asking the wider organisation how they learn best, rather than tell them this is the way that you're going to be trained, so that they can use different approaches for the people, for the requirements of the individuals. So if they say, look, I best learn, you know, kinesthetically, or I best learn, you know, in a different way, or auditory, etc., and they can then use element, I would assume, forms of training that they've developed to be able to do that, down to the individual groups and individuals that learn in that way. I think that's a really great approach.
I'm just thinking of, I mean, Joe makes a good point. You know, it's not refresher training if it's not refreshing training. You know, if it's new stuff, new material, then it's not refresher training. And I'm sort of just trying to get my head, I don't disagree with that. And I think quite like your thought process, Dave, that, you know, it's cover the same stuff but in maybe a slightly different way. You know, if you were doing, you know, similar things, so you're doing manual handling training, or do you need refresher training on manual handling training, and if you did, what's the difference? So you initially training people, you know, there are very basically there are 7-day protection principles. You know, do people just do reminding about that, or should it be going into something slightly different this year because we assume they know that already? Don't know. But anyway, we did spend quite a few hours thinking, well, how can we make refresher training different from the introductory training? And we actually didn't come up with any particularly good ideas, did we, Eddie?
No, but I think there's some interesting points that have come out from here, us speaking together, and what some of the other comments that have come on here is maybe have that kind of palette of different approaches, not necessarily have the different topics in it, but different approaches, so that you're varying it up in the way that
refresher training would work well as a workshop in a way, a team workshop. So initial training might do e-learning, blended learning approach, and the next year you might, well, you're going to sit around and we're going to just talk through this stuff for 20 minutes rather than sitting in front of a computer.
Yeah, I mean, I've actually aware of approaches, and I think some schools have done it in the UK, but definitely over in the US that they use a resource known as the Khan Academy, and the Khan Academy is on our online lessons in academic subjects that you would be taught at school. So, you know, it could be in physics or maths or English. And how teachers have used this, that they've actually turned the methodology on its head. So instead of teaching the lessons in the class, then go away and do your homework where you work through particular problems, they'll send people home and say, your homework for this evening is there are four Khan Academy lessons on a particular element within physics, say, or maths. What I want you to do is do that tonight. Come back into the classroom tomorrow and we're going to work through some problems using the knowledge that you've learnt tomorrow. So it's a slightly different approach. They've just basically turned on its head. And they said that the results that they're getting out of that, because when they've got the theory and they put it into practice and they talk through it, they're saying the understanding then becomes, they understand a lot quicker and they understand for a lot longer.
That's interesting. So what you're suggesting there then is possibly the delivery of training is that they have a PowerPoint slide beforehand to cover off the main bits. And then the training itself is when you discuss and bring it to life.
And you can also pretty much anticipate, I was going to say guarantee, but should never guarantee anything. We can pretty much anticipate that people are all going to be at the same knowledge level. If they've all done the same thing in the same way, you know, and then they're coming to in that environment in a classroom, and then we're working through it in groups, we're working through it as a class, you're working through it as in pairs, and you're actually working through problems that the knowledge that you can use that knowledge to work through the problems. It's like the breadth and depth of it then and how long you take it in for, how long you retain it for, is increased. So I think it's a really innovative way to approach it.
Yeah, that's a really interesting point, because I know we've spoken about this before already, and it's kind of is a different take on a point that I've come across from a guy called Andy Bounds. In relation to and anybody who's interested, do look him up. I think he's a great fella. He does emails and he's on LinkedIn and Twitter and all that, giving the kind of communication and sales advice in essence. But his take on meetings was the fact that we shouldn't be having a meeting for the sake of having a meeting. The meeting should solve something. So therefore, if the meeting's going to solve something, the participants to that meeting should do something before the meeting. So therefore, you've got a sufficient time to discuss. So kind of read this. We're going to discuss points A, B and C to decide on this element of it at this next meeting. And if the meeting doesn't need to be for an hour, let's just have a meeting for 45 minutes, that kind of thing. And I think that's kind of a different, with the dimension with the Khan Academy, what there is in essence to me sounds or feels like the same kind of approach, which is we're going to do this and this is what we're trying to achieve. But in order to do this, you need to do this bit first.
That's right.
In that kind of sense.
You've got a level playing field. Everyone's at the same point and you can be working with the same. Everyone has the same points of reference. And then you can set that environment up to kind of for it to be more challenging. You know, going back to that thing from Princeton University, you've got to make the learning quite challenging for it to impact upon the individual, for them to understand it properly.
No, for sure. So I think that was a kind of a really good kind of thought process, and even picking up on Steph's element there, I'm just coming to the terms with doing these webinars, by the way, that I ought to keep an eye on the chat. So I'm going to thank you to Eddie and Alan for keeping an eye on the chat.
And Alan.
And Alan, but he's kept quiet through this session. But the comment from Steph in relation to Andy Bounds and what he deems as afters is with what people are left with after they've done something. So I think one of I first came across Andy Bounds in a sales conference many moons ago, and he basically said people aren't buying newspapers because they want paper, they're buying the newspaper because they want the news. You sell the news, not the paper, that kind of approach. And I think that's a really fascinating approach to kind of take forward with the training, is what are we actually trying to sell from a training point. What do we want people to be left with after they've had the training?
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, I, and as you know, we've had that conversation regarding Andy Bounds as an approach, but I think it stretches across. It's all about communication at the end of the day. How do we communicate what we want people to understand? And what we need to understand is what happens after that we've done that with them. What do they go away with? What will the impact be? So that must be the raison d'etre. And what we're doing in the training is, What is going to happen after we've trained these people, and will they retain it, etc.?
Yeah, and I think that element, quite nicely ties in with Dave Parsons' chat. I'm going to always be looking at the chat now. I think it's fascinating. I suppose we should add it up early. But Dave's saying that there should be a clear training strategy kind of in place. He's got other comments in there, but a clear training strategy in place. So if we're talking about what we're trying to deliver, what we're trying to achieve, have you actually come across organisations that have a training policy or training manual and kind of detailing what they're trying to achieve, who's going to be trained, the levels going to be achieved,
I've seen in some of our clients some quite sophisticated models, good models, trainees analyses, job by job, role by role, and then identifying when they're going to get some kind of training intervention and what that's going to comprise. I've seen some really good models, and that's why what we have the benefit of being able to do is go around lots of different places and pick all the bits of good practice and think, well, if they were all welded together in one controller or processor, wow, that would be really powerful, wouldn't it? But I've seen some really good stuff.
Yeah, one of the most comprehensive ones I've seen, and it's not, I don't suppose this organisation appears a lot on DPP's podcast, is McDonald's Restaurants Limited. For my sins, in the 1980s, I was a store manager for McDonald's for 8 or 9 years, and I've yet to see such a comprehensive training program in order to fulfill what the organization does on a daily basis. And they need to have their training down to pat, even the process, how they train people, how they track they've been trained, how do they prove that they understand what they're doing. It's integrated into their performance reviews, so it's a complete kind of consolidated approach to how training impacts on the operational output of that organization. And it's the best one I've ever seen. But I don't suppose you don't become the biggest restaurant company in the world unless you've got your methods and your process in place.
Well, next time I go through the drive-through, I'll see if there's a training on the menu, and I'll ask them.
We've not really talked about kind of awareness raising, and so
Just going to try and segue to that, Phil, because I was just going to ask about training policies, whether it includes awareness training. So that's where the and kind of informal training and stuff. So that's where the segue to try and move on to. The awareness is going to come in.
Yeah, I was thinking, you do the whatever it is, annual training, month for training, bi-month, bi-annual training, sometimes we've seen, then what? Is there nothing until you go through retraining, or is there the opportunity of having, other softer input, through awareness raising of key points or topical points or... we've talked about this before, haven't we? There's certain things in the calendar year, like International Data Protection Day and, all sorts of other, celebratory days that you can piggyback. But this all requires time and resource and, the ability to think through, well, I want to get this message across, across the organization, and I'm going to do it in this particular way. But again, we've asked lots of things for customers. I did some screensavers for a customer to reinforce the messages a few months ago for Kathy. We've done posters, we've done balloons, we've done chocolates, haven't we, printed chocolates. We've got mugs printed. We've done also at Everton when I was there, we put the key parts of the business strategy on little key cards and handed them out to all the staff, a bit like, we put them on the back of their security pass. There's loads of different techniques you can use. It's just having the time and potential budget to kind of progress with them.
Yeah. I mean, well, we're in on a platform at the moment which is doing exactly that, these podcasts every week. I mean, it's an awareness approach, for not just for our organisation, for other organisations as well on topics.
So what you're saying, Eddie, well, you're not really saying it, but I'm thinking that you're saying it, is that we could do anyone could do 5-minute snippets on something. So we mentioned data protection principles, or I have several times, but who cares about the data protection principles, how many there are? It's what they mean. What is fairness? What is lawfulness? What is transparency? What is purpose limitation? What actually is storage limitation? Well, you could get the essence of that over you know, in a 5-minute discussion between, you know, nutters like us or internal members of staff, and then put them out on the internet. And, you know, again, if they become obsolete or old, you just replace them, don't you? So I think we've got all the tools we need to make this really good.
I've seen an example of that for concepts which are hard to get your head round. There is a thing called Philosophy Bites, which is a podcast, which a gentleman who used to be a lecturer for the Open University called Nigel Warburton, and he takes philosophical arguments and philosophical pieces and then talks through them so that people fully understand. He's like the Brian Cox of the philosophy world, but people understand those kind of quite ethereal philosophical arguments once they've listened to certain people have talked through, and they're just talking through it in general. Well, what do you think this means? How could we approach this? And I think that's a really great approach to break down that very kind of maybe stodgy way that it's put together, and kind of breaking it down and talk through it so then other people can engage. So yeah, a great idea, I think, that is, Phil.
Trick or treat, Victoria, hey? Muffins and cookies or sweeties. The company dentist is in because of all the training we've been doing. I didn't realise the time had marched on so much. We've only got a few minutes left, haven't we?
We have, yeah. We normally wrap this up within about an hour, so we're closely marching onto that time. has anybody got any kind of last-minute takeaways, any other questions, any kind of left-behinds? Or cupcake moments from today's session.
I have to say, I mean, anybody can dive in and cut across me. I'm quite cool with that. But one of the things that Eddie and I have been talking about is developing kind of awareness raising as a service. So if it's so labour intensive to put neat ideas together to reinforce some of this stuff, then potentially, you know, we could do it for all our customers for a, you know, tiny fee, because it's a volume game, isn't it? We could produce some materials every week or every month or every quarter, you know, and, you know, the format like this could say we want it to cover this, and actually we could contribute to putting it together, and therefore maybe there isn't a fee. But, you know, if we can do this better as a community, then, you know, why aren't we? You know, we could get hold of it and put together some really good stuff. And if we don't like it, don't worry, we'll just replace it. You know, as I said, we've got the tools to do it. And
I think that's a great idea, because if you're talking about informally organisations having chats, even team meetings, we could push out topics to talk about in that sense. So you're taking the pain out of thinking about what we have to cover and can we put a schedule together, or even looking, like you say, around points of the year. So it's always bonfire nights coming up. Let's think about data retention and things. So you could push out some bits, you know what I mean, in that kind of sense, that could be really useful to kind of ease some of the resourcing issues with trying to get this thing, kind of get the drip with the awareness.
Yeah, and I think that you sometimes just get a kind of a light bulb moment when you hear other people talking about topics in a maybe anecdotal way, and you thought, well, I've never really approached it or thought about it in that way. So, you know, I think that kind of snippet, that kind of small podcast about certain topics is a great way to go.
We'll have to have a play around with it and put some prototypes together.
Yeah.
Dave, anything else you wanted to cover today? I can't remember who wanted us to talk about training awareness. I think it came in from some customers, didn't it?
I think it did, yeah. The main thing for me, and by all means anybody can and jump in, the main thing for me really is it revolves around inclusivity and making sure that the training's accessible to everybody within our audience. We're not losing segments of staff. We're trying to show that we're taking it seriously because we're proactive about it. We're trying to show that we're taking it seriously because we're covering various different topics. We've got awareness and training, but all that is inclusive of individual learning styles, individuals' difficulties that they may be facing. Through hearing, sight loss, and so on, that we discussed earlier. So I think whatever the training needs to be in place needs to be considered considerate of that. But then in addition to that, the training must be impactful, looking at what Eddie was talking about earlier. And people have got to remember it, whether we talk about people, whether we relate to the person, whether we try and find some ways for it to be impactful, for it to be remembered in a fun and interesting way. So it's just, again, trying to think out of the box about how we might deliver that. From my background when I was working in marketing many moons ago, you had this kind of point of most marketing. I think it came from a guy called Steve Harrison around advertising. And most adverts and things that you remember on TV had an irrelevant abruption in it, as in the bit that made you stop and think. There's something in every advert. And if you can't remember the advert, then the advert didn't have it. And the advert, in essence, in his argument, should never have been aired. In that kind of sense, you need a kind of a stop and think moment. And if you get that stop and think moment, people will remember it in that kind of sense. And it's that, trying to get that element from my point into training, making it fun, making it engaging, making people think about it, making it be impactful, but making it inclusive to everybody.
Yeah, I totally agree with every point you said there, David. So I'm glad you said it so I didn't have to say it.
I can't say it twice because I've done that off the cuff.
I mean, as ever, there's been some great comments from the other participants on the session today, some, you know, really good things to think about and to take away. You know, it's been a good session, I think. What are we talking about next week, is it?
I think it's back to GDPR radio next week. I don't think there's any topics. Miles is on, so I don't know if Miles wants to just unmute and introduce next week's session.
Well, it is GDPR radio next week, but it's extra special because you, Ollie and Phil are all going to be in the office at the same time, so
that'll be the first time ever, I think.
There you go, mate. Christmas jumpers out in full force.
No, that won't be happening.
It's too early to start talking about Christmas.
Well, let's hope something happens in the news then, because there's been this big bit flat, I thought, in the data protection news this week.
Well, I mean, it's also almost bang on a year is next week. It's bang on a year since we started recording these sessions. We've been doing them for about a year and a half, but recorded. Today is session number 51. And we've only actually missed 1 week in the last year. So in the last 52 weeks, we've actually only taken 1 week off, which is crazy.
I've heard with the boss about that one, Miles.
So I think if anything, next week's GDPR radio should be sort of a look back at everything that we've discussed over the last year and any changes that have happened, really.
I think a little bit of a review would be good, I think, yeah.
Definitely.
I
mean,
it's kind of a bit of the highs and lows. I don't know if anybody can troll through the history and put bits and pieces together, but there's highs and lows. Well, we can throw that into the mix and discuss it with GDPR Radio next week.
Definitely. Dave's top 10 soapboxes, that'd be a good one, wouldn't it? Dave's top 10 soapbox moments.
Good, right. Well, does that wrap up what we're doing?
You can get back to your stew now, Phil.
Got to jump on it.
It'll be cold now.
It was cold anyway. It's already been reheated once, so you can't reheat things twice.
Anyway, let's wrap things up. So let's say a massive thank you to Eddie for joining us today, our internal guest speaker. So thank you very much, Eddie. Thank you, as always, for your contributions, Phil, and everybody who's taken part in the chat today. It's always great to have you on the session. It's always great to have your thoughts and feedback. And likewise, feel free to unmute at any point and join in with the conversations. But once the three of us, and even when Ollie's with us, we can get our elbows up a little bit. It can be a bit hard to join in, but it is your session. It's a great little kind of community that we've got. And so do please keep listening and do please keep joining in. And we'll hopefully see you next week. So thank you, everybody.
In the meantime, have a good weekend. Yes.
Cheers, thank you. Have a good weekend. Yeah. Cheers.
Bye.
You too. Bye. Yes, thank you. Bye-bye. Bye.